So yeah, I just want to say how pleased I am to be giving a talk on Kshitigarbha. It is actually 4 years to the day that I was introduced to the figure in my private ordination ceremony, as Param Bandhu said. So that feels very, very auspicious to me. And also, as I say, I've never heard a talk before given on Kshitigarbha, so I'm going to be listening to this talk as well as you listen to it as the first time I've heard a talk given. I'm going to refer to Kshitigarbha as a hymn, because that's how I relate to this Bodhisattva. But when we're talking about this level of experience or reality, we go beyond distinctions such as he or she. But for convenience, I'm going to refer to Kshitigarbha as a he, okay, as a he. To give you an outline on what I'm going to say, and to create a context, I will say something about the language of symbolism, and how I relate and respond to it, and the importance of giving it a place in our lives. So I'll say something about that. Then I'll say something about the myth or history of where this Bodhisattva emerged from, some of which will come from this sutra, the sutra of Bodhisattva Kshitigarbha's fundamental vows, okay? I'll say something from that and give you some information from that. And some of the other information I'll be talking about, I've just picked up over the 4 years that I've been meditating on the figure, okay? So I've been researching the figure over these 4 years. Okay. Then I'll talk about the Bodhisattva qualities that I've noticed since I've been meditating on the figure, and as Prama Bandhu said, he's my yidam. So that he's my connection to reality in a symbolic form. He's my Kalyana Mitra, so he's a spiritual friend. In a sense, I've got a strong connection with this figure. And as I said, I did ask for the practice. Kshitigarbha emerged out of a book one day at me, and I thought, I could sense an emotional connection with this figure. And I did actually ask for the practice, and Ratnagosha kindly gave me the practice. And I like to think my ordination 4 years ago was my spiritual death. Okay, so at my spiritual death, I was given my new name. I was reborn with a different name, in a manner of speaking. And I took up the practice. And I like to think that I didn't choose the practice, really. Kshitigarbha chose me. Okay, that's how I sort of like to think of it. So I'll say something about symbolism now. So you might notice different things to me about Kshitigarbha. That's the beauty of a symbol. So when you reflect or meditate on these archetypal figures, different qualities can surface at different times, probably depending on what you might need or what you might need to develop. Symbolism or myth, stroke myth, I'm talking about the same thing here really, are a language, a common language, only in the sense that it speaks to everybody's depths, okay? We all understand this language somewhere, if you see what I mean. There isn't anybody that isn't affected by symbolism or symbols or myth. I think every day, one should say every night, in dream consciousness, when we're asleep, there are symbols. Maybe you could say at night there is just symbol consciousness, or just a stream of symbols. So generally, waking consciousness ignores that they've occurred, but nevertheless, they've arisen in the mind, and having done so, they have an effect on us. In some schools of thought, the symbols in dream consciousness anyway are said to be compensatory to the waking state. So they have a balancing effect, or they're said to have a balancing effect, or that they are statements about the current state of consciousness. For whatever reason these images occur, they are generally symbolic. Okay, so I'm just trying to prove, as it were, that there are symbols already in our consciousness already. So this stuff is archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas we come across. They're there somewhere. We just have to sort of try and look for them. So just as the brain has the early reptilian brain beneath layers of later developments, which we still need and use, so we have older inherited layers of consciousness that were probably in use before language. Beneath the everyday problem-solving thinking kit, we have a layer that speaks and understands this language. Would somebody get me a drink of water? I'm getting a bit of a dry throat, please. Thanks. So we all have this level of consciousness. And if we're serious about practicing the Dharma, we should be exploring symbolism, particularly through puja, reflection on the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And you can also explore symbolism through art and poetry. There are probably more. Okay. Banti has a lot to say about all this in his book, The Guide to the Buddhist Path. There's a whole section on the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Thank you, cheers. Yeah, have a look if you're interested in archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in Banti's book. Yeah, The Guide to the Buddhist Path. I'm going to be mentioning a few of Banti's books, because Banti Sangharakshita's books are absolutely loaded with lots and lots of really good Dharma and lots of stuff on symbolism as well. So I'll be recommending or mentioning a few more of his books. Also, you could have a look around the centre, okay, for different symbols. There are lots of symbols speaking to us. There are lotuses on the wall in the courtyard. There's the Nalanda crest, the Nalanda crest above the big red gates, also in the courtyard. Have a look at it. There are deer on the Nalanda crest, one with horns, one without horns. There's a wheel with a swirl in the middle, at the centre with colours, three different colours. There are flames on the Nalanda crest. There's gold. There's a huge red lotus there as well. All these have symbolic meaning. We have a seated Buddha in one shrine room here, and a walking Buddha in the other shrine room. Okay. They can have different emphasis and have different meanings. There are flowers, incense, water, candles, and soon there'll be Arloka's painting in the basement, which I believe this series of talks is sort of exploring. Arloka's images are very good to look at, very rich in symbolism, so hopefully we'll get to see that soon, sometime in November, I think. So these are some of the symbolic objects around us. Then, of course, there are symbolic actions. There's the Sevenfold Puja, the symbolic acting out of the Bodhisattva path, starting with the initial response of respect and worship through the different stages, right up until awakening itself, expressed by the concluding mantras, which are sound symbols. Okay. There are funerals. There are marriages. These are all symbolic ritual elements that are around us in our everyday life. There are mitra ceremonies. There are ordination ceremonies, public and private, symbolising different aspects of one's commitment. As it were, this archetypal level speaks to us through dreams, visions and poetry, as I've always said, and meditation, a myth, and we speak to it through symbolic acts. And allowing these images to affect us, gradually a dialogue opens up where these figures, these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, are then able to affect us more strongly. And we begin to live much on a more mythic level, which provides us with a bigger context in which to place our lives, or you could say it gives meaning and direction to our lives. Okay. So the upshot of what I've been saying is that we need to acknowledge that this archetypal layer is there, whether we like it or not, and we need to let our imagination play with it. Okay, we need to play with these images. So so now I want to talk about Kshitigarbha, and as I do, just try to let go into the imagination as I speak, and allow any images to arise and percolate in your mind. So there's a particular sutra that Kshitigarbha is associated with, and it's sometimes called the Sutra of Bodhisattva Kshitigarbha's Vows, or just simply the Kshitigarbha Sutra, which tells how he came to be a Bodhisattva and the vow he took, which is something of this Bodhisattva's speciality, which Prema Bandhu mentioned about the hells. I'll talk about more about that in a minute. The myth goes, and this is from the sutra, the myth goes that a young Brahmin girl's mother dies, and she makes many offerings because she is concerned that her mother has gone to an unpleasant place due to her slighting the three jewels and being a wicked person. So the Brahmin girl prayed. She prayed to find out where her whereabouts. Then she has a vision, and is transported to a hell. Okay, she's transported to a hell. There are lots of hells in this sutra, and this is where she meets a demon king, and he tells her that her mother left the hell for heaven 3 days previous, and because of the huge amount of offerings made by the girl, lots of other beings have also been liberated from the hell. Okay. The girl is now Bodhisattva Kshitigarbha. Okay, so that's the myth, the story in the sutra. At some point in the sutra, the Bodhisattva vows, Kshitigarbha vows, to the Buddha that until Maitreya appears, that's the Buddha of the future, Kshitigarbha will dedicate his energy to saving those in states of woe, in states of hell, particularly those that have been forgotten, lost, or ignored, given up on, condemned even. Okay, so this is who Kshitigarbha is really interested in. So this is what Kshitigarbha is concerned with. He's concerned with closing down hell. He just wants to close it down, put a big close sign across it, so when you arrive there, you can't get in. Okay, that's what he's concerned of doing. So closing down hell, and just putting all the fires in hell out forever. This is his speciality. This is what he vows to do. So he's willing to go to places where there is suffering and help. Traditionally, he's concerned with this lower realm, the hell realm. And I'll mention some of the hell realms from the sutra, because there's lots of them. I'll just read straight from the sutra. So Kshitigarbha replied, "Sir, fully respecting Buddha's majestic spirit and the Mahasattva power, I shall now give you a brief account of the designations of various hells, as well as the different sorts of retribution for different kinds of sins and evil actions. Sir, in the east of Jambudvipa, there is a mountain called Chakravarta, iron enclosed. This mountain is dark and deep and receives no light from the sun or moon. Here there is a major hell named Avicii." If you've read the Bodhicharavatara, Shantideva often mentions the Avicii hells, and the Avicii hells get mentioned here. "And there's another hell called Mahavichi. There is another hell called Four Corners, and I'm going to start abbreviating this. There's another one called Flying Sword, Fire Arrows, Pitching Mountains, Iron Cart, Iron Rack, Iron Cattle, Thousand Knives, Iron Mule, Molten Copper, File Heads, Peak Eyes, lots of strange names here. There is another name, another hell called Fight Quarrel, maybe you know that one, or Iron Axe, or Much Hate. And there are more. There's one called Shout Hell, Excretion Hell, Copper Lock Hell, Fire Elephant Hell, Fire Hound Hell. So there are just lots and lots of hells there in the sutra. So it would seem that there are plenty of difficult mental states that we can get ourselves in. That's what I'm assuming these hells represent. There are lots of ways to get into a bad state, and it's very easy to do that. The sutra also says a fair bit about karma. Karma means action, and it's also emphasising karma vipaka, which is the result of action. The results of these actions, obviously, is that they're emphasising that you end up in hell. So it seems to be reminding us that we just don't have to experience these kinds of mental states in the sutra, and that we are the main cause of these hell states through our own actions. We put ourselves there, as it were. And of course, the sutra is also communicating the unfathomable depths of the Bodhisattva's compassion. The compassion of Kshitigarbha is sort of there. It doesn't really get mentioned very much, but it's obviously there. So now let's have a look at the Bodhisattva himself and see what might be there for us, what might open up for us as we reflect on this symbol, this living symbol. So the figure I meditate on is upright. Okay, that's the figure down there that I meditate on. In Iloka's painting that we're going to be receiving, and on the FWBO refuge tree, which I believe Paramabandhu mentioned at the beginning of the series of these talks, he's actually sitting down. So different, these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come in lots of different forms. So often you see him sitting down, and he's got one leg stretching out to the world. Okay? If you're interested in going to see a large rupa of Kshitigarbha, there is one in the West End at a Chinese temple, which sometimes I go and visit and make an offering. He's got a room dedicated to him, and all around the room there's different names. Yeah, it's a Chinese temple, and there's Chinese names of people that have died, and you can buy a space in this in the shrine room. Anyway, it's a very big fig, but he's sitting down, he's not standing up, the rupa. And the figure that I meditate on is standing, as I said, and he wears monastic robes, which are patched and very ornate, they're very beautiful. He's a young, shaven-headed monk, and in his right hand he holds something a bit like a staff, as you can see it there, with six rings on the top. And that's called a kakara. And in his left hand, he holds a flaming jewel to his heart called a chintamani. I'll say more about those later. And he stands on a white moon mat, which rests on a golden lotus. Okay? In the Far East, he's very popular. I think he's only second popular to Avalokiteshvara in some parts of the Southeast. and he's a very, very popular figure in Japan, known as Jizo. And he's in Japan, he's said to be the guardian of travellers and of dead children, particularly those that didn't make it to birth. And if you go to Japan, you'll see, Sarah was mentioning today, and I was aware of this, but if you go to Japan, you see images of Kashiti, lots of Kashitigawa images around, and they have people leave children's clothes by the Rupas, and they even put them on the Rupa. So that's how he's seen in Japan. So let's go back to the lotus. It's a very, very important and common symbol in Buddhism. In Vajrayana Buddhism, Buddhas or Bodhisattvas are often seen on them. They are symbols of perfection and beauty. When I was in India on pilgrimage, I saw lots of them growing around the Mahabodhi temple. The Mahabodhi temple is where the Buddha experienced awakening. And I had a young boy come up to me while I was there asking a few rupees for one. And I think that's probably the first time I'd ever really seen one close up. And it was just an amazing, it was a huge, massive thing. And he was trying to sell it to me so that I'd make an offering to the Mahabodhi temple. And I can't remember whether I did buy it or not. But anyway, it just really struck me. It was like a red or a pinky colour. And at the same spot, the Buddha had a vision of humanity being like a lake full of lotuses, with beings in different stages of development. Some just beginning to emerge from the mud, and others ready to open. So generally we could say that anything above a lotus is the transcendental, it's very important. More poetically, we could say whatever's above the lotus is the sweet nectar of the flower. Yeah, sweet nectar of the flower, the essence of something. Okay. So this is no ordinary flower, and it's even more unordinary because it's golden in colour, again not of this world. Gold, so I mentioned this golden piece of cloth here, gold is a solar symbol, okay, a solar symbol. Solar, as I mean like the sun, okay, it's associated with the sun with what might be said to be masculine qualities. That's energy, the rational, strength and power, and destruction. Okay. Solar symbols are common in different cultures all over the world. Immediately above the golden lotus is a white moon mat. This balances up the ferocity of the solar energy, the solar symbol. The moon mat or disc is a lunar symbol associated with all things that solar symbols are not. That would be the non-rational or intuition, receptivity, patience, nurturing, or what you might call feminine qualities. Okay, so the moon is very, very soft, and recently I was having a conversation with Koti, and we were talking about the moon in India, and the moon comes up, and you can actually read by moonlight, and it's almost like there's this, I can imagine India, the ferociousness of the sun, and in the evening this lovely soft moon comes up, and you can sit out and read. So yeah, anyway, this is what the moon's associated with, these soft feminine qualities. So these two symbols, which aren't really two symbols, they complement each other. In fact, it seems to be saying that the emergence of this bodhisattva rests on the balance of these two different aspects of ourselves. Either that we have to make these qualities conscious in ourselves, or we have to develop them. Either way, we will have to explore these different qualities in our experience. This balance of things is often repeated again and again in these kinds of images. Arloka often puts the sun and the moon in the top corners of his paintings. Above the right shoulder, the sun, and the left, the moon. This being how the Vajrayana images, this is how they usually are. The tankers, you see the sun over the right side, the moon over the left side. The right side said to be masculine again, and the left side said to be feminine. So this is where symbols come into their own, because the thinking mind finds it very difficult to bring these two opposite qualities together. You wouldn't normally find these qualities in the same place. We normally think of either male or female, if you see what I mean. Whereas an image can communicate these qualities. And although it doesn't seem to communicate to the conscious mind, it does to the unconscious depths. And hopefully those qualities percolate up in a manner of speaking, and our everyday consciousness descends, particularly if we reflected on these images, and they meet. And this is what I was saying earlier about a kind of dialogue going on between our unconscious and the conscious mind. This dialogue takes place, or can take place. This is why we can find puja and ritual so confusing, because the conscious mind expects to understand it, okay? But the conscious mind generally doesn't understand what's happening. But it can't do anyway, not at least not straight away. So if you have that experience, of really trying to understand puja and not getting it, and wonder what's going on and why you're doing it, that might be that you've got too much solar, if you see what I mean. You've got too much masculine, rational sort of type energies, and not that you should shun those kind of energies. Only that you need to become more aware of your lunar qualities. Maybe read more poetry, myth. Study your nighttime experiences during your dream state. That can awaken this level. And then you'll notice that far from being foreign, that these colours and some of these images can appear while you're sleeping. So let's now have a look at the Bodhisattva more closely. First impressions are that he is a symbol of the goal, okay? He's a symbol of the goal. Bhante says somewhere that when practicing visualization, that it's you at the end of the path. He means you as an enlightened being. A lot of Buddhist symbols are symbols of the goal, okay? They're mainly symbols of the goal. One notable exception is the Wheel of Life, where you have a symbol, the opposite of the goal, which is samsara, or the reactive mind, which just basically whizzes round, caught up in greed, hatred and delusion. But from an image of the goal, or an image of this goal, we can work out the whole path if we reflect long enough. In fact, the path must be present during... No, sorry, the path must be present because your goal will contain your path, and your path your goal. I think it was Gandhi who famously said that if your goal is peace or non-violence, then you must use peaceful means or non-violence to get there. Okay. This is how we can see the precepts. We can see the precepts that we practice as an expression of the goal. That's how a Buddha would act. They would act naturally, ethically. So they can be an expression of the goal, or they can be the path that gets you to the goal. You can use them to practice to get you to enlightenment. So what do we think this Bodhisattva's path was or is? Well, he's a monk. He's wearing monastic robes. He's got his head shaved. Maybe he's been in a monastery for a long time, okay? And, they're all observations, but we can be a bit too literal about these about these things, about these observations. So we mustn't take these symbols too literally. So what I would ask is, what does the figure of the monk convey about reality? Yeah. So what does it convey about reality? So the first thing that maybe comes to mind, or my mind anyway, is commitment. So my associations are that monks dedicate themselves for a very long time, maybe even for life. So they are dedicated and committed. My next association would be that he is very robust and willing to take a knock or two or three or four. Okay, so I'd assume he's very robust because my imagination, he lives in a monastic setting, and I don't think there'd be many comforts living in a monastery. Maybe there will, I don't know, but I'm assuming he's very robust, and that he can take a knock. When I mean a knock, I mean that he will be willing to find out that he's not who he thinks he is. Okay. So you will need, or we will need, to be robust on the spiritual path to discover our heights and our depths, to navigate the twists and turns of the path. And you can develop robustness and dedication by simply meditating every day. Okay. If you are choosy about when you meditate, then you won't get to experience yourself fully. And we really need to learn how to be with ourselves. One way of dodging that is telling ourselves that we don't feel like it, that we don't feel like meditating. If you say that to yourself, you might want to reflect, well, what is it that I don't feel like right now? Or what is it that I don't want to feel right now or avoid? Okay? Maybe we're avoiding something unpleasant. Worse still, I think, by not meditating regularly, we miss out on joy and pleasure that comes through being willing to be with ourselves. And I don't necessarily mean experiencing pleasure during meditation, I just mean at other times. So if you meditate, you're developing positive mental states, so it's possible that they may arise outside of meditation. So these are some of the heights that you may experience outside meditation because you meditate regularly. That's my point. So you miss out there as well. So I'm just encouraging you to meditate regularly, I suppose. That's the message. The Bodhisattva is also said to be in the form of a young monk. So to go along with his robustness and commitment, we have youthful spontaneity, which I think might mean, in the spiritual life anyway, keeping your sense of humour. So there's laughing and joking on the spiritual path. Often a harmless joke can dispel tension. And Maitra Bandhu is very good at this. If you've met Maitra Bandhu, you probably will soon if you haven't already. I've been in many meetings where there's been a bit of tension in the room, and Maitra Bandhu has picked up on it, and he said something funny, which has allowed the tension to be released just through a bit of humour. And everyone starts laughing, and everybody goes, ah, and the tension's gone, if you sort of mean. So, we need to be spontaneous, and we need to keep our sense of humour. So the Buddhist path isn't a grim, solemn affair. If we leave out humour and lightness, we'll end up feeling frustrated and tight. So we could also see the robes of the monk, or his renunciant lifestyle, as an expression of his positivity, his mental state. Often we think of a monk having to shave his head and wear robes as a discipline, but maybe it could be an expression of a positive mental state, possibly. because don't forget we're looking at a symbol here. It's an expression of maybe not being tied down by anything. He's just free to wander, free to stay put, or free to express. Okay. He's unhooked from the mundane, no longer bothered by how much he's worth in money or what new car he might buy next. There is no trivia and frivolousness. He's completely happy with what he's standing up in. Okay. So we've had a look at what the Bodhisattva is standing on and what he's wearing. So let's have a look at what he's holding in both his hands, still keeping in mind what I said earlier about working out what the path might be to realise this image of the goal. Okay, in his right hand he holds what looks like some kind of staff, as I mentioned earlier, or a walking stick. And it is significant that this goes everywhere with him, as a walking stick would. Okay. So it's called a kakara. Sometimes you see the arahants in Aloka's paintings with them. I think they're on the FWBO refuge tree. It's basically a long stick with an arrangement at the top with six rings attached to it. In early Buddhism, there was a school called the Savastavans, a monastic school who was said to carry these. According to Banti in his The Survey of Buddhism, the Savastavans were the most geographically widespread and historically the most important of the early schools of Buddhism, which appeared in around about the first century after the Buddha's Parinirvana. In the myths that have been built up around Kshitigarbha, it's said that the rings on his kakara make a noise. Okay, they jangle, and you can hear him coming. And apparently, all the hell beings run away when they hear Kshitigarbha coming. He's also said to use it to bang on the gates of hell, just to let them know he's outside and that he's coming in. On a more practical level, I can imagine these monks walking around, and maybe they did make a noise. Maybe these kakaras did make a noise, so people could bring out alms to feed the monks. Okay, so let's turn our imagination to these six rings. Well, they could represent the six perfections, or the six transcendental virtues of the Bodhisattva, which are Dana, Sila, Kshanti, Virya, Dhyana and Prajna. Or translated, they're generosity, ethics, patience, energy, meditation and wisdom. Okay. Some years ago we dedicated a year to each of these, so I'm not going to say much about them. If you're interested in them, have a read of Banti's book, The Bodhisattva Ideal. He really goes into them in depth. So I want to talk about the kakara from a different point of view and how it fits in with the myth of the Bodhisattva. And when I use the word myth, I mean something that is true or has truth in it. I think in our scientific times, myth has been devalued. It used to be that if something was a myth, then it was trying to communicate truth. But these days I've heard it said that so-and-so is only a myth, sort of relegating it and meaning it's not to be believed. And I've heard myself say it, so maybe I'm reminding myself. But really we should watch out for this, because myth, you could say, is an accumulation of wisdom over the ages. Maybe instead of talking about our spiritual path or our spiritual life, maybe we should talk about our mythical path or our mythical life. Maybe that might bring things alive a bit more. So mythical life, yeah. I think that would be a better fit to describe sort of what we're doing, what we're trying to do. In the FWBO Puja book, we have the Sevenfold Puja, which I mentioned earlier, and it's recited at centres all over the world. That's because of the importance Bhante Sangharakshita has given it. And one of the important reasons are that it tells of the story and poetic form of the life of the Bodhisattva. We recite it together and collectively, and we get to ritually act out the myth of the Bodhisattva. So when we engage with these myths, we may begin to experience the truth that's hidden in them. That's the point, or one of the points. So another take on the six rings connects back to Kshitigarbha's vow to save all those in the hell realms. The six rings can represent the six realms as seen on the wheel of life. That's the human realm, the realm of the gods, the titans. So they're the three upper realms. And then there are the three lower realms, the realm of the animals, the praetors, and the hell realms. Okay, they're the lower realms. So we can see the Kakara as a statement of his intention to work in samsara. Samsara being where greed, hatred and delusion are the main driving forces. But he's particularly concerned with those who have been forgotten. Those who have been given up on, who no one else can help but him. So what can this mean in terms of the path for us? Well, we've probably all got this place in us, like a hell, okay, where we just don't want to go. Because down there are all sorts of things that have been forgotten and lost, at least by the conscious mind. Often we see these bits of us in dreams as rats or black dogs. I know I've seen these things, maybe you have. Or some other shadowy figure that seems to have come and come to frighten us. Or maybe we see these demons in the day at work in other people, or in our families even. These people that we react to, especially those ones that keep buzzing around in our head, particularly after the event, the ones that won't leave us alone. Those little demons or big demons that can buzz around in there. And when they get going, it's as if there's like a demonstration going on inside our heads. I mean like a demo, you know, like the ones that you see outside some government buildings. I had an experience recently where I was cycling down Roman Road and I could hear lots of shouting and whistling. And I thought, what's all that racket? And in the distance I could see people with placards and banners. And they just wouldn't shut up. They were just making lots and lots of noise. Even when I come into the centre, I could still hear them. And that's because they were trying to get some attention. And they were trying to get the attention of someone in the Tower Hamlets office. I don't know what they were exactly trying to communicate. And I thought, oh yeah, that's what demons do. They sort of stomp around and they try and get your attention, and unless you give them attention, they won't sort of calm down. So they want to be heard and acknowledged, basically. That's the conclusion I've come to. So I'm making a point here about how we relate to our inner world, which will always be reflected in our outer world, because they're not really that different. And what we're talking about here is integration. Integration of all those parts of us that we have condemned. The bits of us that we've locked away because we don't want to look at them. So let's personify those bits. Maybe you've got these bits in you. And let's just personify these bits for a minute. Now, what would you do if you were condemned? How would you feel? Okay? You'd probably get pretty upset. You probably make a big fuss and get really annoyed. So maybe you can empathise with these demons that are there sometimes. So another way of saying this is whatever you resist persists. So what Kshitigarbha does in this instance is builds a relationship between what is resisting and what is persisting. Now, this resisting and persisting is based on a very old myth, or a very old story which we learnt when we were very young, and it basically boils down to good and bad, or good and evil. The bad is go to hell or prison, condemned basically, and the goodies go to heaven or they live happily ever after. That's what heaven is, living happily ever after. But somehow more baddies turn up from somewhere. So how many times have we heard this story again and again in different cultures, different films? And there is a myth, this is a myth, but the truth in this myth isn't that we need to become good. The truth is that when you demonise someone else or parts of ourselves, they never go away. Okay, this is the truth. This is the truth. This is what I think the truth is in this myth. They never go away. Hence the eternal battle between good and evil all over the world. So that's what we really need to notice. If we keep pushing away, if we keep condemning ourselves and condemning other people, it just keeps happening. Okay? It just rages on. So we've internalised this myth in the wrong way. I think we've misunderstood this myth. We think to become good we must push away evil, but Buddhism emphasises a critical awareness, an awareness of all those energies that need to be brought into the service of the Dharma. Okay? So we're talking about the importance of developing a relationship with those parts of ourselves which we have become split off from, which I'm saying is like our hell, what Kashiti Garb was interested in. So how is it possible to develop a relationship when we have invested so much energy in keeping the disruptive parts out and develop strong habits in doing so? It is difficult when we encounter these parts of ourselves, wherever we might see them, because when we do, we experience fear, very, very strong fear. We're very, very frightened. So one of the ways that we encourage, well, we need to be in a positive state to deal with fear and discomfort. So one of the practices we teach at the centre is the metta bhavana. So of course there's the metta bhavana and the mindfulness of breathing. Especially the metta bhavana, because, as I've just said, we saturate our experience with positive emotion, which can come into relationship with difficult experience more readily. And then there are other clues as what to do about fear in the Pali Canon. An example is when the Buddha feels fear when he's walking in the forest, he stays with it, and he stays with the fear. Meaning he wouldn't be gritting his teeth, tensing himself up or bracing himself. He will be allowing himself to feel the fear in his body. He can be using mindfulness. Because it's the body that is telling us to run away. Often it's the body that tenses up, and that's the signal for us to run away or fight. So these feelings, they're unpleasant feelings, what we call vedana. In Buddhism, that vedana is feeling, a very basic feeling of pleasant, unpleasant or neutral feeling. So there's instinctual fear, there's instinctual feelings that are almost hardwired to ensure the survival of the species, okay? We do need this instinctual fear to jump out of the way of cars, but our psychological fears won't kill us. Not like a car will. So your body is a sense organ that communicates things. It's not just a carcass that carries around your head or the bit in the middle that connects your arms and legs up. So let's hear what Banti has to say about vedana and the importance of experiencing vedana. So that's the importance of experiencing feeling. So this is from his book, Living with awareness. Again, I'll just read from the text. Judging from what one reads about them, one gets the impression that people of previous times experienced their feelings in a much more full-blooded way than we do in the urbanised modern world. What stands out in the accounts of ancient and traditional societies is their sheer emotional energy. Take the ancient Greeks, for example. In the days of Plato and Socrates, it seems that people took their friendships very seriously indeed. If they loved you, they would love you without reservation and do anything for you. But they hated unreservedly too, and made fearsome and even ruthless adversaries. Life today might be more comfortable, but in comparison with the people of earlier times, we seem to live in a very flat, lifeless, emotional state. Going to work on the bus or packed in a crowded train, our emotions are for the most part disengaged, and we simply try to get through the day. One might well say that in this tepid, unresponsive state, we are out of touch with our feelings. Why is this? One obvious fact of life these days is that it is very complicated. The traditional society in which one was born, lived and died in the same place among the same people is a thing of the past. Many people move every few years and have to build up a new social network time after time. In these circumstances, they have little chance to build up strong friendships outside the nuclear family, and the weakness of the connection with others makes it difficult for them to respond emotionally to the people around them. However, as Western psychology tells us, those strong feelings do not go away, but remain repressed on a subconscious level. One of the aims of psychotherapy is to bring them to the surface and restore a full awareness of oneself as a whole personality. When Buddhist psychology refers to developing mindfulness of feelings, however, something rather different is meant from the getting in touch with our feelings with which psychotherapy is concerned. Something less complex, though perhaps more useful. Indeed, being able to identify feelings in the sense of Vedana as defined by the Buddhist tradition is what makes it possible for us to follow the Buddhist path. So he's really emphasising there that we really do need to be in contact with our Vedana, with our feelings. Okay. So Bhante seems to be saying that if we want to transform ourselves, in this case transform our fears, then we need to be willing to experience the Vedana connected to them, particularly in the body. Another way of transforming demons is using the four tantric rites. They are like magical spells. They're strategies employed by some Tibetan yogis when working with intractable situations, even in meditation or daily life. There is a famous story called the Tower of Red Rock Valley, where Milarepa, the central figure, who is a famous historical Tibetan yogi, uses them. The story goes, maybe I should say a rite, the tantric rites are a bit like a rite of passage. They're sort of things that, symbolic acts that you can do to move a process on, if you see what I mean. They help, just like if somebody dies and you have a funeral, that helps the whole process move on and helps you let go. That's what these tantric rites, that's what these rites are, like rites of passage. So the story goes that Milarepa has left his cage, where he spends most of his time meditating, to collect some wood. And while he's away, a storm comes up and the wind blows and knocks all the firewood he's collected from his hands. And at that moment, he's exhausted and he faints. He passes out. So he comes round a little later and makes his way back to his cave. And inside there are three unwelcome visitors. There are three demons who are said to be of the Indian variety. I don't know why that's in the text, but that is. And they are hissing, spitting and growling. They're very, very scary. Milarepa isn't happy. And without thinking, he tells them to leave. And at this, the demons become even bigger and more menacing. He then recalls he is a Dharma practitioner, and realises that this is a very good opportunity to practice. So we can do this. I mean, we can react very strongly, or begin to, and then we have a choice between working ourselves up into a very bad state or doing something else. So we could reflect on the fact that our Kalyana Mitras, our spiritual friends, wouldn't want us to get ourselves into more of a bad state than what we already are. They wouldn't want us to be distressed. So this is what Milarepa does first. He recollects his Guru Marpa, which is a traditional practice in Tibetan Buddhism. In fact, a lot of Milarepa's songs start with some devotional words to his guru. So this generates, he recollects his guru, and this generates what we call Shraddha, or confidence, faith. So it's a very, very positive state he's getting himself into before he deals with these demons. So having done this, he uses the tantric rites, which are described in one commentary as being like generating or cultivating a succession of moods in relationship to these demons. So firstly, he uses the red rite, or the rite of fascination, to draw the demons towards him. Basically, he changes his stance or attitude and invites them to stay. He's friendly towards them. Then he uses the white rite, or the rite of pacification, to pacify their energy. Milarepa is no longer resisting them, so their energy to persist in scaring him is no longer being fed. And basically, the energy is returned to Milarepa. So he's starting to fully acknowledge these demons, and as it were, the energy, that's his mind out there, and the energy is starting to return to him. He moves on to the yellow rite, or the rite of prospering. So this will be a great, it's the rite of prospering. So this will be a great gain for Milarepa, as he will no longer be scared by these particular demons. And in that sense, he prospers. His confidence grows. He prospers in confidence. And at this point in the story, the demons come together in one vision. So they're weakening, and they come together in one vision. And then finally, the black rite, or the rite of destruction, comes into play. This is the last rite that he uses. What this means is he sees that they are qualities or aspects of his own mind, they're projections of his own mind, and more importantly, that they have no inherent existence, and they just disappear, they've gone. So that's the story, the tale of Red Rock Valley. It's one way of engaging with demons. So we're seeing here that from his initial resistance to the demons, he develops a relationship with them until eventually they leave, or as he sees them from a different perspective, sees them for what they are. And this is a good guide for us in what we need to do in difficult situations. So one other thing about fear, I've said that we need to try and experience these fears in our bodies, and using body awareness. And unlike Milarepa, our demons probably won't disappear the first time we come into relationship with them. We will have to keep experiencing our fear over and over again to overcome our fears. We will need to keep coming into relationship with what we fear. Maybe you fear groups. Maybe a group is a collective demon for you. Or maybe it's someone in the group that presses your buttons. Whatever the situation it might be, some communication around it may be necessary. And certainly being mindful of the Vedana in your body will help. Okay, so I'll be concluding soon. I just want to say something about how we might help others that might be in distress, that might be in the hell realms. Well, for someone who's in a bad state, a friendly inquiry or looking out for someone can make a big difference. And I want to give you some instances from my own life when someone has taken an interest in me, when I felt lost and forgotten. They've taken an interest in me when it's really, really mattered and really helped me. So just over 20 years ago, I was in a lot of trouble. I got myself into a lot of trouble. I'd been mixed up with selling drugs, and I'd landed myself into prison. Okay? I'd been remanded in custody, and while I was in custody, my brother come and stood me bail, which I was very appreciative. So I managed to get out on bail. I was out on bail. I was on bail for about 7 months before I finally went to prison. And while I was on bail, I met a probation officer who would see me each week and give me support. And she also kept in contact with me during my sentence and after as well, when I was paroled. So that all that time I felt cared for in a non-judgmental way. So I'm making a point about when the chips are down, you know, small things can make a big difference. It really did make a big difference to me, because I did feel like I'd been sort of lost or pushed out of society, and I needed to be sort of drawn out again, and it really helped me. Also, while I was in prison, I was in solitary confinement. This was probably the most difficult point of my life. So I was on suicide watch. I was not allowed to keep any shoelaces or razor blades in myself in case I used them to harm myself. And after about 3 or 4 days, I was in a very bad state indeed. The prison officers that are stationed on the solitary unit in prisons are some of the toughest guys in the prison, because they have to deal with, you know, obviously you can imagine what it's like in there. And they're some of the toughest guys, some are possibly as tough as some of the convicts. So prison is quite a brutal place. You're not meant to like it. Anyway, I was in quite a bad state, and one of the senior officers who was in charge of the wing came into my cell. At that time, I hated all the prison officers, but this man was being very, very friendly toward me. And he said that he would leave my cell open a few inches, and if I wanted to talk, that he would be across the corridor. And this made a really huge difference to me. And that's the point I'm trying to make, that small acts of kindness can make a great difference. So at the time, I was in a hell. But this small thing, someone trying to connect with me, was a real great relief to see some warmth, some real human warmth in this complete, what seemed like a complete hell to me. So yes, small acts can have powerful effects, so don't underestimate them. Sometimes, though, someone in a bad state may refuse our help, and we have to respect that. We have to respect how people are. If they don't want to be helped, maybe we just need to be patient. So, if you like, these have been some of my encounters with the quality of Kashiti Garba, the compassionate, empathic quality of the Bodhisattva. Of course, Kashiti Garba's compassion is unfathomable. His endless altruistic activity, not only wanting to relieve suffering in an ordinary way, but wanting others to experience awakening, enlightenment, bodhicitta, whatever you want to call it. Kashiti Garba never gives up on anyone, because he is always in contact with the spiritual potential of living beings. He knows that everyone can become a Buddha. He naturally resonates with others. There is a beautiful word in the tradition called anukampa, which means to vibrate with, often translated as compassion. So he vibrates with the need of others to relieve themselves of suffering. And he knows the only way is through Dharma practice, through developing the bodhicitta for all. Talking of bodhicitta, let's just move on to Kashiti Garba's left hand, where we find a flaming jewel, the Chintamani, which is synonymous with the bodhicitta, or enlightenment itself. It's pressed against his heart. I like to use the more poetic term of the heart's gem. So since we all have a heart, then we all have a heart's gem waiting to be discovered. As hard as it may seem, we can all grow into a Buddha. As we've heard, that's what Kashiti Garba believes. When we chant the threefold puja, we hear the Buddha was born as we are born. What the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. So we're being reminded that we can make spiritual progress, And we must cultivate this right view to make progress. We need to believe in our own potential. It's not easy to become enlightened. But if we just put in the same effort that we put into defending and building up our ego, then we'll make rapid progress. There isn't any lasting happiness in samsara. There is happiness, but it doesn't last. So there isn't any happiness in egotism. Whereas finding our heart's gem, awakening itself, is irreversible. It's an irreversible knowing, an irreversible wisdom, an irreversible joy. It can't be undone. The bodhicitta can't be undone. So the left side of the body on these symbols is synonymous with wisdom or the feminine, and the right side is synonymous with the activity of wisdom, in this case, which is compassion, which we've said is the masculine. Wisdom is feminine in Buddhism, and it's personified by a beautiful goddess called Prajna Paramita. It's she that gives birth to the Buddhas, and the birth takes place through the realization of shunyata, or emptiness. So her wisdom gives birth to the Buddhas, okay? Gives birth to them. So that's our little skirt around some of the imagery with Kshitigarbha. There's a lot more. There is a lot more there. So just to finish, I want to just say a final note, and that it's possible to be over-focused on what is unskillful in our experience or what is difficult. So we can turn ourselves into a problem. So this needs to be balanced with what is already skillful and positive. It's easy to focus on the hells and what we need to integrate and blah, 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 but there is a lot of positive, I suspect, well, I know, I think there is a lot of positivity there already. So not only inquire as to why you might be in a difficult state, but also notice why you are in a positive state, okay? As it were, if I'm up in the Deva realm, how did I get there? What did I do to be up there with the gods? I'd encourage you to try and make it a practice of noticing why you're in a positive state. If we do this, we will naturally do more of it, and we really will be following in the footsteps of Kshitigarbha by closing down the hells and finally putting out the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion.